My name is Jim Lundy, and we're doing a session on skills and love, two sides of self-esteem. And there's several ways we could title this, but we want to look essentially at the aspects of unconditional love and performance as separate but interacting aspects of our own sense about who we are. Of all the sessions that I've been working on and working with you on, this is clearly the hardest one to do a good job on. And I'll tell you why from my standpoint. Because sessions where we address a symptom or a particular relationship like marriage or a particular problem have a focus for us. When we talk about self-esteem, there's lots of information, there's lots of opinions about how to create it, there's lots of discussion about what it is. And I think that if we give this topic the respect we should, we'll agree that it's a fairly slippery topic, and that it's easy sometimes to say, well, if we just give people enough love, or if we just give them this or that, good self-esteem will develop. But I think you would agree with me that in the same families, you find people growing and developing with a sense of self-esteem and other people not. You find that people discover it in very different ways. It's a pretty diverse topic. And one of the things I want to do today is respect some of that diversity instead of try to sell you one way to achieve it. Let me give you an illustration of this. There was a lady on the radio on Dobson's program, Focus on the Family. You're probably familiar with that. She was talking about how she raised her children and how she was very effective that at the age of two that she could leave all of her finest glassware on the lowest coffee table, and the children were able to respect that. And she was giving the formula about how you could do that with children, and she's a very well-known child educator. And Jim Dobson very, very gently suggested to her that was an excellent model for her and part of the population, but it probably couldn't generalize to everyone. And he was doing a good job there respecting diversity. And it doesn't mean that her strategies and approaches wouldn't work for some children, for some parents, for some individuals. But clearly, if we did that with all children, and more, it would be more difficult to do it with boys than girls, because in general, boys have more physiological drives to move, called hyperkinetic energy. Girls have it too, but in general, boys have it more. So we want to really respect diversity today and not come up with one way to create self-esteem. If someone could come up with that, they would be a hero in our world and culture. And we don't have any heroes in that department. We have a lot of good voices. And I want to tap into some of the good voices, and we want to use your good voice today too, because some of you know quite a bit about this. Well, let's start by a simple reflection, and this is an important place. What kinds of things does high self-esteem correlate with functionally or behaviorally in you? Now, this isn't a class on parenting, although we'll often refer to parenting. It's really a class about me, about you. What does high self-esteem correlate with in your world and in the world that you see? What kinds of things do people with high self-esteem do? How do they act? How do they function? What are some traits?
Confidence.
Confidence.
Positiveness.
Positive.
Flexibility.
Independence.
Mm-hmm. Acceptance.
Acceptance? That's a real important one.
Affirmation.
They can give and receive affirmation. Uh-huh. How does it correlate with sexuality? Sexual behavior? Any ideas?
It's heightened.
It's... I just couldn't hear you.
Heightened.
Heightened?
Heightened.
Heighten.
More important.
Sexuality is more important?
Yes.
H-E-I-G-H.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. We had a sex educator here last week that was sharing with us work that she does with dating attitudes in preteens. And she was talking about a great deal more confidence in sexual identity among kids who have high self-esteem, meaning they know what they want to do and what they don't want to do, and they end up being the choice makers. Okay, what does low self-esteem correlate with?
Self-destructive behavior.
Self-destructive behavior.
Indecisiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Indecisiveness.
Anger. Sometimes. Okay, so it's
she thought she was hiding.
Yes, his mother really exists. Okay. So self-esteem is a very useful idea. It's something we value in part because of the way it affects our behavior. How do most people, how would you fill in this sentence? I ask people a lot just in my office, or they tell me even before I ask them. I just want my kids to be
successful
and
healthy.
Right. The first words were happy that we heard here in the room, and those are predominantly the words I think that we hear. I just want my kids to be happy, normal, successful, okay, not in a great deal of pain, and we have high investment in this. How would you end this sentence? For myself, I just want.
Peace.
Peace.
Love.
Love.
Appreciation.
Allowed to be myself.
Do you note that we answer that differently? That's a real important difference. Very, very important. Do you think you want something better for yourself than you want for other people, than your kids, per se? No. Clearly not. Clearly not. People want the best for their offspring, for their family, for those we love. But you ask for something for yourself that's harder to get. Peace, to be myself. And it's important, I think, for us to understand that that is the road that self-esteem comes from, not the road of just being happy. And although I think what we're saying when we talk about our kids that way is we just want them to not be in pain. But pain is probably an important part of self-esteem. It's on the performance side, it's on the skills side. Well, I want to tell you a couple of illustrations and talk about a model of human behavior, and then we'll jump into this. Our practice group had kind of a sobering experience. We invited a consultant to come, you know, just look at how we worked with people and how we related to each other and so on and so forth. And so we hired an older, very experienced man in mental health, and he came and he sat us all down, psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors. And he looked at us all and he said, well, I just want you to know I'm not here to judge you or hurt you. What do you think our response was?
That's what you hired him for.
Essentially, that's right. We sort of scratched our heads and we looked at this man and we said, okay, get on with it. We're adults, we're big people here, we've all been through school, we've all had pain. Just get on with what we asked you to do. And he looked at us again. And he's a very stubborn fellow who's pretty sure about what he knows and wants. And he went around and he looked at us and he said, you don't understand what I said. I said, you need to know. You need to be aware enough of your own insecurities and vulnerabilities. You need to be in touch with those enough that it matters to you that somebody would say, I'm not going to judge or criticize you. Now, I still didn't get it. I don't understand this. And he kept explaining and talking to the point that I did get it. And what I got was an awareness that one of the things we need before we move into performance and skills is an awareness of our need for affirmation, awareness of our anxiety, awareness of our insecurity, awareness of our weakness. And when we deny that, we're probably going to operate out of it defensively and not even know that it's there. And so he did a very interesting thing.
in his first point with our group, which was really an intervention, a way of beginning to bring some gift to us. And it was that the first step of personal transformation is being able to acknowledge our need to not be judged and not be criticized. Because if we feel we've got that licked or whipped in and of ourselves, we're probably in denial about some of our own anxiety and insecurity. And so his thesis to us then was that the first step to self-wholeness, self-esteem, doing a good job at what you do, is to be aware of that side of ourselves. Do you have any comments or reflections on that? Is that some of your brain?
I've just come to believe that next to the instinct for survival, acceptance is the most needed thing within our personality. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get that one way or the other. Mm-hmm.
I would certainly agree.
I've always had a very difficult time taking any kind of criticism. I always thought of that as a weakness. And you say that, and just that gives me a little crack in the door, like maybe it's okay for that to hurt.
We have a grandson that's been coming down upon his mother because she refuses to try to find his father. And she knows that what the repercussions of that would be. And he doesn't seem to understand. He isn't old enough to understand. And it wasn't until he won two races with the first through sixth grade in our town that he quit coming down upon her. But his acceptance of his ability to run has really whacked him off. And we're so thrilled about it because we needed that. We really needed that.
Yeah, we all need that. And when we're ever in a place that we aren't aware of how much we need acceptance and love, we probably cut off a part of ourselves that's going to come back and fuel behavior and energy in other ways, and probably self-destructive ways. Well, I did a little experiment after this man came to our practice group. I had always held out the hand of compassion and kindness and empathy to poor, hurting, needy people when they walked into my office. But when attorneys and engineers and physicians walked into my office, we sat down and did business. I mean, they're not in need of as much compassion, and they certainly never acted to me like they wanted. So I did an experiment. I started telling, quote, high-powered people when they sat down, even people who were 60 and very well-to-do and very powerful in our community, I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to hurt you. And I was amazed. I mean, it shocked me. It was one of the biggest educations I've ever had. Because you know what these people said? Oh, thank you. Now, there was never, in my previous work with this category of individual, never a sense where they were soliciting, nurturing from me particularly. They were soliciting information, advice, insights. Sometimes even analysis, but not soliciting nurturing. But when I offered the nurturing, it wasn't rebuffed at all. It was grasped. And that was really a surprise to me. And I've seen a lot of folks in the last 10 to 15 years, but beginning to tell people that has been a whole education in how much all of us are looking for that. And so it was an interesting week with this man, as you can tell from a man who would start with our group that way, and that's all I want to tell you about that week. The next thing I want to talk to you about is the Portland Trailblazers, since I'm from Portland. And you probably don't want to know about them. They didn't win the tournament this year anyway. But what I want to talk to you about is genetic and biological and cultural differences, and athletics is an easy way to understand this from. Some of you have seen this model, and please bear with me if you have. But when we talk about self-esteem, one of the mistakes we make is that we find one technique or one thing that works, and we apply that to everybody and wonder why the soup doesn't always taste the same. And it's because because the ingredients are different. And we've talked before that our self-awareness is made up of thoughts. Oh, this pen isn't going to work at all. I can't even get the butters out. It's made up of thoughts and feelings. Okay, thoughts and feelings. Flowing into that are four simultaneous streams. The stream of your personal history or your psychology, the stream of your genetics or your biology, the stream of your environment or your culture, and the stream of your spirituality or your values. And these impact simultaneously in at different ratios your own sense of who you are. And sometimes we make a real mistake when we jump into this area of self-esteem by not respecting how complex people are. And let's try to give a little example from each of these areas to help us understand how they can affect your sense of well-being, your sense of self-image, your sense of self-confidence. And we'll use athletics for part of that. But let's start with biology. If we were going to make a selection of people for an athletic team, I would be much more interested in biology and genetics than I would be practice any day. And where did I learn that? Not from being an amateur TV sportscaster, you know, watching TV and commenting all the time. I learned that from the people in Portland, in part, the physician who helps select athletes. They select them on the basis of genetic endowment. Now, it takes practice, but great athletes are the genetic Rolls Royce of humanity. And so, you have a person like Clyde Drexler. You know what he eats at halftime? Hot dogs. Why? That's true. He'll send out for a Coke and a hot dog at halftime. Why can he do that? Because he got from the Creator a genetic self, a genetic capability, vision, coordination, and other things that we don't need to go into that are very different than us. Well, look at how different people are in sports capabilities, and don't minimize that in terms of personality style. See, we tend to think that everybody should have the same personality style. And what personality style is highly valued in America?
Outgoing, gregarious.
Outgoing, gregarious. What's valued in school?
Performance.
Being a thinker or a talker?
A talker,
you know. So what happens is, in terms of developing self-esteem, sometimes we assume that we're trying to create the same type of a person, and it just doesn't work. Because if you have a person who's introverted, thoughtful, nonverbal, they're going to develop, when we get to the specifics down here, their skills are going to be sometimes very different than people who are extroverted, verbal, talkers, and so on. So we really want to value ourselves and create some room for diversity here in terms of our biological uniqueness. Now, I believe that in the Christian world and in America, that the forgotten organ is the brain. It's an organ. We treat it as if it's this silly putty that we can mold so that we could all be the same or achieve the same type of person or the same style of personality. But a great deal of who you are style-wise, interest-wise, is in that organ, and a part of it just came to you genetically and the way it was wired and the way it grew and developed as you were a young infant. It's very hard to change the wiring of that organ. It can be done. If you think it needs changed a little, don't despair. We can change our style. But we also need to very much respect them. Okay, what about spiritual values? Are they diverse? You know, in Holden we just say yes and we sort of say that automatically. But in lots of our culture, in lots of places where people grow and develop, or where you live, or what the church you're in, diversity there isn't respected, is it?
No.
There was some passion in that.
What's from Minnesota?
Okay. And so again, you might have a spiritual interest or a spiritual way of looking at the world that's not the same as someone else's. And they might try to push you into their mold. And in that happening, you would find things damaged. Oh, okay, thank you. This will just help us. I'll just use. We'll try this one. There we go. Thoughts, feelings is your human awareness. We're talking about biology, now we're talking about spirituality. This flows in here as well, it creates thoughts and feelings, and these interact with each other. But if you have a particular interest in spirituality or a way of knowing God or a way of finding meaning, and someone says that's not okay, that's going to hurt you. And so there's more than one way to be spiritual, just as there's more than one way to be biological. And what I'm saying here is that sometimes when we approach self-esteem, we assume that there's one generic person, and if we treat this person in a certain way, it'll always work out. And that's not the case. It's not the case. So a big part of you making peace with your self-esteem is really coming to know who you are in these areas. Now we have the environmental or the cultural area down here. And again, diverse interests. A lot of learning goes on here, and we need to understand where we came from, what our background is. And over here, what have I left out so far? Oh, our psychology or our personal learning history. All of these things flow into our unique person. So I don't want us to develop a discussion of self-esteem that says, if you'll just do these three things to yourself or these four things to your kids, it'll always turn out here. It's not the case. Our children are utterly different. Unfortunately, they're as different as my wife and I. And that's very different. And that can be okay when you learn to respect diversity. But if you come from a background like I did, which was a very conservative church background, and a middle class America model of life, diversity wasn't accepted at all. We looked for one generic kind of a person who could turn out a very one kind of behavior. So these are real important to analyze and to understand. And that is what Holden is about, is giving ourselves that respect. Well, let's look at the list you have in front of you and talk about it a bit from our standpoint. These are from a book called Raising Children for Success by Stephen Glenn. It has a new title in its new edition, which is, I think, somebody know that exactly? Raising Self-Reliant Kids in a Self-Indulgent World.
I thought that was by Jane Nelson.
Jane Nelson is his co-author. Stephen Glenn has a learning disability. And so he produces tapes primarily. But this is the one book he wrote, and then she rewrote it with him. And she puts most of his ideas into words while he puts them into tapes. So you're right, Jane Nelson is his co-author.
I checked at the bookstore and they didn't have it.
It just means it's sold out then.
Oh.
But it's in print. You can get it at B. Dalton's or whatever bookstore is.
It's worth it.
Yeah, this is really good stuff. And we just selected a bit from
the publisher.
The publisher, I don't know if it's changed. He printed this with his own press, Sunrise Press. It may be published by another publishing house now. You can find it. It's easy to get hold of.
What's the name of the new one?
I believe this is close, it's not exact, Raising Self-Reliant Kids in a Self-Indulgent World. But read it about yourself. Don't just read it about your kids. And that's what we're talking about today is, you know, getting getting in touch with my capability. And we're going to start with skills. See, sometimes when we talk about self-esteem, we talk just about the affirmation of the unconditional love, which is where I would start, and it's where our consultant started with our group, much to our dismay. But I wanted to spend some time on skills, because sometimes we act like skills don't relate to self-esteem. And they're enormously important. They're the other half of the coin. They're one of the reasons that if you have children that are really in trouble, we take them outward bound. And what do you learn in outward bound? Skills. What do you learn at boys' camp and girls' camp? How to cut wood, how to milk cows, you know, how to take out the garbage, how to do your own bedroom. Skills. And why? Because we think self-esteem is not, affirmation is important, not at all. Because sometimes when we get really damaged, to open the door to affirmation, you need to develop some skills. And again, it's not the same for everybody. See, some people, that isn't the door in, but for many it is. Well, let's look at this. It's entitled Capability. We all want to make a significant, important contribution to our significant social group or family. That's an important thing for you and I to make peace with for ourselves. I want to be important. How many people here want to be important? You can raise your hand or not. But again, that's sort of one of those things that, you know, we're socially trained to say, no, I don't want to be important. I don't know if you can relate to his chuckle or not, but certainly that's the way I was trained, was to absolutely want to be important, to want to have a skill that made a difference, and yet always get to the back of the line because, well, I'm not supposed to want to be important here. But we desperately want to be important, and our kids want to be important, and everybody we meet wants to be important, not in the sense of being grandiose or applauded. And this is where it gets confused in Christianity. Some people will tell me, I'm just so full of pride. I went on the women's retreat, and I made a special breakfast for everybody, and it was a surprise, and I brought helium balloons, and just made it so neat, and all the ladies got up, and they loved it, and I realized that afternoon what a sinner I was, because I was selfish, and I just wanted to make a show of myself. And you hear that? I hear that. And I have to say to this person, you know, that isn't meism. That isn't pride. Meism and pride is when I take somebody else's power or capability or take what's theirs. And that's just you wanting to make a significant contribution to your group. And that's wonderful. We want to be important. Now, can 50 of us in this room all be important at once? I think so. Now, not in the sense of all being noticed at the same time, but we really can begin to develop an idea, an awareness that we all make a contribution. Now, for some of us, that'll mean changing our world a bit. And that's what Stephen Glenn would really suggest. He would suggest that our culture has changed to the point that it's hard for us to be important at the same time. And so there's a lot of competition for being important, and most of us lose. Most of us come up short at the skill level. And these are the barriers to being important. The first one is assuming. And assuming, another way to say that is mind reading, or going on old tapes or old programs. How much do you assume in new relationships when you're just getting to know somebody? A lot. Tell us about that.
About what you assume?
Yeah. What might you assume when you meet someone?
Well, the assumptions would be around the feedback that you get from that person. And so you might assume that since she smiled back, mm-hmm. she's equally interested in me.
Mm-hmm.
Since she took the time to talk to me, maybe she likes me. if you're going to the same church, you might assume that they have similar spiritual beliefs.
So he would say that assuming is a barrier to knowing myself or to knowing other people, and that it comes. And on the flip side of your sheet, you have his major transitions in lifestyle. And he would say that these are some of the causes for the increase in barriers, and that we need to work to reverse this trend. But that assuming is needed because we have low family interaction time. We have little time to spend with each other. This morning in the text study, I can't quote this exactly, but someone talked about spending 45 minutes in the ice cream line the other night and how relaxing that could be. Where would you ever wait 45 minutes to get an ice cream cone? You know, I'd like to wait on the yogurt stand. You wait 45 minutes to, but we don't do that. There's a reflection on how time changes when you're at Holden Village. Interaction patterns change when you're here. Well, Stephen Glenn would say that those interaction patterns were intact, like that line, prior to World War II, but now we are in a big hurry. And, you know, Jim and Kathy's session on family meeting is so wonderful, and it's exactly in line with this material. And I ask upper middle class families to have family meeting, and you know what they tell me? And they're dead serious. That, you know, it's not a joke. They simply lean forward, and Dad will tell me, we don't have time. You tell me another way to get this family together. And he's not a bad man. He's not antagonistic. He is caring. He is compassionate. See, I'm not against that man at all. That man is me. That man is you. That man is busy in American life, the way we live it. And I'm asking him to change his lifestyle. And he's being very honest with me, saying, boy, this is tough to do. Now, I believe we need to do it. I'm not saying don't do it. But checking versus assuming is time consuming.
But our society awards that.
Our society rewards it. You bet. It rewards me not taking care of myself.
Right.
That's right. Because it holds out some of the things that I think are affirmation if I'll do these mm-hmm. other things.
Society also discourages checking things out. Like you'll hear behind the scenes comments about, man, he's dense, or she just doesn't get it, does she? Uh-huh. And it's because everybody else is assuming, mm-hmm. and that person is checking it out. Mm-hmm. And so that's another way that society kind of chips away at our self-esteem.
It takes time, and it takes being willing to let ourselves be the kind of people we are when we check in with ourselves, when we begin to reflect and inquire about who we are and what we really think and what we want and what fits us. It's so easy to do the assuming, which in our own lives is often role-playing, to fill in the role the way I think it should be lived, rather than getting in touch with me and how I want to do it. Nice illustration of how you like to put people in molds and keep them growing. When we were doing Jim and Kathy's practice the other night for filling out the self-esteem bracelets, our very verbal daughter had hers done before my wife and I did. I mean, you know, get it done, folks. This is easy. She wrote everybody's out. I hand them to us. Our thoughtful daughter wouldn't do it. She's still thinking. She got hers done later that evening. And they were much more thoughtful. Much more insightful. But you see, if we don't respect our own differences, we force ourselves into other people's molds And then what do? We shortchange ourselves and we end up performing poorly. Have you ever done something before you were ready and failed and then decided you were a failure? Rather than taking the time to do it in a way that works for you, getting it done well, and delivering a good product. Very different. Our verbal daughter, who gets wonderful grades and is praised and all this, you know, she's too young to listen to this tape. I can't talk. When she gets about 15, she'll be smart enough to listen to this. But at 11, I can talk about her. She wrote on my wife's, "You're a good cook," and on mine, "You're a good tennis player." Now, are those superficial? Yes, very superficial. Our 9-year-old daughter wrote on my wife's, "You take good care of our animals and you're nice." And on mine she wrote, "You make good jokes for our family." Now, those are more thoughtful, you see. Those are a lot different. But in terms of getting it done, completing the assignment, who's going to get the initial rewards?
But our schools, see, encourage
that's
that.
Right.
We have children that can't.
Yeah.
Every day I see it, where they can't. They're just not that kind of person, and so they fail.
And time limits on tests.
Yeah.
That's the California Achievement Test. There's a time limit.
But let's look at ourselves. You're right. I mean,
we took those tests when we were kids.
We did. That happened to you. And so you now have to discover your own timetable. You have to check in with yourself. Do I want to go on the hike? Do I want to go to this church? Do I really want to work this way? Who am I? Check in. Inquire. Okay, let's move on to the next one. Number 2, rescuing and explaining versus exploring. And the idea here, again, is that it's very much related to time and to a fear of pain, but that we often step in and rescue so that the person doesn't experience pain instead of letting them explore. And Stephen Glenn has a neat illustration because he works a lot with inner city kids. And I don't know the details of this, but he was letting some young kids cook breakfast and do their own eggs. And someone came in and said, you know, "Aren't you worried that this person's going to burn themselves?" And his response is, "I'd rather they burn their finger now than burn their life later on." In other words, we need to learn by trial and error. And he also has another nice phrase, which is, "Feel free to make decisions for people if you don't think they're ever going to have to make their own." It's a little simpler, but it gets the point across that many times failure is seen as so bad that we rescue. And that's behind the idea of enabling. I can't let you fail. I can't let you do something and blow it. And so it's important in ourselves to look at that and see what I might want to try, but what I might be very afraid of failing at. And these are the no's that we impose on ourselves out of fear. Let's see if anybody wants to share an example of that. An area in your life where, in a sense, you would like to do some exploring, but there's a voice that says, "No, let somebody else do it. They do it better."
I wanted to write a book for about 15 years, and I'm afraid to write the first word because I'm afraid when I finish it, nobody will want it.
And what if they don't want the book?
See, I'm working on just such a book. I did the front of it about 10 years ago, and the credits about 6 years ago. Now I'm really picking up on it and what I want to do with it. So I'm collecting Bible verses. Mm-hmm. So if you want to be a part of my Norwegian American Bible verse recipe book,
there's
your Bible verse.
There's your invitation. You know, this is where, again, self-esteem has to be so customized, because self-esteem gives us the ability to have boundaries and say no, doesn't it? to set limits. But some of our no's don't come out of healthy self-esteem, they come out of this fear, this way that we cut ourselves off. I won't write a great novel, so I shouldn't write a book. Anybody else want to share?
A few years ago, I just in a church that I joined, I'd never thought of myself as a good reader, and especially reading aloud. But it was a small congregation, and for some reason, I got forced in, talked into reading in front, because we all take turns within the congregation reading the lessons. And after doing it a few times, I realized that I didn't do so bad. And that was really difficult to do at first, reading in front of people, just taking that, breaking the barrier in my mind that I couldn't do it. It was hard.
That's right. So find ways to explore for yourself. Let yourself develop in some of these areas. And you have to do the checking in with yourself first, or you won't know where to go. I mean, and this is what people say to me. I say, you know, go ahead and find out who you are. And they say, well, I don't have any idea. Well, check in. Check in and then do some exploring. Give yourself that freedom. Okay, let's move to the third one. Directing versus encouraging and inviting. Directing comes from the idea that it's easier for an expert to do it, or an expert has the one right way, and that somebody can come into a room and tell us how to be. And we've all had that experience. And we can even do it in self-esteem class if we're not careful, that we can leave here with the idea that somebody told us how to develop self-esteem in myself or in my kids. And it's just not true. What happens when you receive direction? What happens inside of you when this happens to you? Rebellion?
You feel like you can't do it.
Superficial.
It's superficial?
Mm-hmm. When I first started teaching voice, it was directive. It was, you've got to do this or else. Mm-hmm. I have learned through many years of teaching voice that the best results is to teach them self-awareness, mm-hmm. and to teach them, what do you feel when I say the tone is better? And this is making them explore themselves and making that connection. And so that works better for me now, is that you allow the student to become self-aware of what's going on in their bodies when they sing.
Do you get that example? I mean, that's really all we need for the whole class. that's a summary of so much of what we're saying. What could be more frightening than to go to a music teacher and be told, you know, sing this now this way? What would that do to me? I know what it'd do to me. I would absolutely wilt inside and fake it. I'm sure I'd fake it. Probably wouldn't leave. But inside, I'd feel like about a six-year-old little boy. But I'd try to please this person. But what she's saying is that she's learned ways to invite people, to encourage them, to notice themselves, and she becomes their coach, their ally. I don't know what, I don't want to put words in there, but I'm just expanding what she's saying. Very much so. And I bet some of you have music teachers on the directing side. And you learned, but you also probably were limited in your learning by the criticism, by the experience of not measuring up, as opposed to this idea of being invited. I know my response at church is enormously different, and I'll bet yours is too. If we have someone who invites us to a project, as opposed to tells us that this should be your spiritual journey. You do well with that? No, you don't. But you know what we often do? We often capitulate to it.
Very often we go along with the program. We just feel lousy inside while we're doing. Okay, number four. Number four, these are his words, and we need to use his definitions or we'll get lost here semantically. Expecting is a good word, but what Stephen Glenn means by expecting is that we have high standards and we focus on failure. By celebration, he means high standards but focus on progress and success. And many of us have an enormously difficult time controlling our criticism of others. Anybody would want to be willing to share a bit about that? It's so pervasive in our society, you would only be speaking for the person next to you.
Well, you demonstrated it when you first started. I'm not going to judge you or to, that's it, is not judging others.
But mostly we do.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly we do. It's just something in our fabric right now. We focus on the failures, and I think it comes from our fear of pain and some other things, our lack of understanding of how healthy people develop, because you know, some of the healthiest people have gone through the greatest amount of pain. You could all share stories about that.
I think our own sense of low self-esteem almost demands a perfectionism kind of attitude, and we pick that up within ourselves. We're not perfect, we don't like ourselves, so we don't like you because you're not perfect.
Yeah.
We transmit this onto other people.
Yeah.
It's projection. I notice that the better I feel about myself, the less judging I am of others. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that happens at Holden, is that if people come in here with a negative attitude, it doesn't last very long, because the mode operandi here, like you go to the lift is a good example. People will go in there and do things, or Vespers, to get up in front of crowds of people where they've never done it before, but the sense is that even if I blow it, they'll love me anyway. And it's not so much like that outside. It's real scary to try things that we haven't done before.
This contrast between expecting and celebrating is something I've been struggling with for a couple of years with my son, and it reflects on what I did to myself as a kid, that I had very high standards as far as grades in school, and I could get 4 A's, but I would kick myself for the B or C that I might get. And my son's here had a really hard time with one class, and he did end up getting a D, and I was terrible with him about that D and totally ignored the 2 A's he got. And it was awful, and I could hardly stop myself from doing it. And I knew what I was doing while the words were coming out of my mouth. It was awful.
Right. You know, you've given an example of what was just mentioned, the idea of projection. And you see, that's where our feeling self does not come just from our thinking self, but it comes from our deep life history, the feelings that come from way from deep within us. And what we do, and I think several people have said this, and the word projection is the word that summarizes this, I put my biggest fears of myself out here on someone else, and then I don't own them, but then I can stand back and criticize you. And what I really do when I criticize you is give a little public sermonette on how scared and insecure I am. Except if I've done American Life good enough that I've consolidated enough power. When I criticize you, nobody ever looks at me. They only look at the person I'm criticizing, because I must be okay because I've consolidated quite a bit of power in and of myself. And so this is the end of the story about why, interestingly, some of the people that are most responsive to the message of I won't judge and criticize you are some of the people who've consolidated the most power, because that rise to power has been fueled by insecurity. I remember the first time I counseled someone who was a public figure in terms of athletics or entertainment, and I was scared to go in my own office, you know. And so I went down the hall and I talked to an old psychiatrist, and I said, you know, how do I go in there and talk without my voice shaking? Should I take a copy or what should I do? And he looked at me again very kindly, and a different man, and he said, well, you must understand that many, many times the higher the person has been able to rise in terms of public visibility, the more insecure they are about who they are. And if you drop down and meet them at the level of their person, you're going to find that it goes very well. But what was I reflecting? I was reflecting my own anxiety and the way I had used what? My consolidation of power by being a professional to deal with my own insecurity. Because really what I said was, there's a person in there with more power than me, and that's the only way I know how to feel safe. Now, this wasn't last week, but I'm not done either, you know. I mean, it's a journey that we're all on, and I think that it's one that we need to be aware of where we're at in that journey. And very often we close our eyes to it. But celebrating is a nice idea. That's a good word. Again, Jim and Kathy had an idea in their group of celebrating kids' birthdays for a week. Now, their idea was not that you give them a present every day. That would be American permissive love. You know, let me just dote on you, and somehow that will translate into self-esteem. And kids out of well-to-do parts of our culture don't come out with high self-esteem, not if the unconditional love has been given through permissivism. But if we learn to celebrate who people are, what they're like, the speed they go at, how they make decisions, what's important to them, then we're getting to know people. And you know, that's the idea behind celebrating somebody's birthday for a week, which is a wonderful idea, to take that much time to rejoice in who a person is specifically and uniquely.
Europeans do that.
They got more time than we do.
You should do it only because I don't have time to present. I mean, it kind of stretches out because, oh my gosh.
Your priorities are different. Mm-hmm. Your priorities are much different.
Okay, the fifth one here from Stephen Glenn is adultisms, meaning why can't you, why don't you, why haven't you, judgments coming out of the authoritative position versus respect. You know, what's happening in your life that you're doing this or that. It's an issue of respect again. And then just I want to save a few minutes for general questions and discussion. Point two on your outline is affirmation. And again, we've talked about this already, so I won't repeat much of this except to say that Bowlby makes a point that affirmation needs to come from both parents. And if I'm thinking about myself now, I need to think about how I received affirmation from mom and dad, or men and women, and what am I doing to finish that business if I didn't get it done? Because if I didn't get it done, it's probably lingering in me. And so we need to think about ourselves. And for Bowlby, the best illustration for him of affirmation is having a home base, having a place in yourself or in the world that you say, that's my home base. That's where I refuel. And having that inside of ourselves and literally a place both. But the place doesn't have to be a mansion. You know, home base isn't about how big it is or how expensive it is. It's about that it reflects who I am. And then finally, some thoughts on random non-correlated affirmation. One of the problems with skill development in our culture is that we reward people only when they perform. And that's what causes us to take performance out of discussions of self-esteem. But we must bring it in, because our skills are as important as anything about us. It's just that we don't want to become skill junkies or skill addicts. And what I mean by that is that we get lots of straight-A kids who have terrible self-esteem. They've got the skills, but no love. And what they do is they'll jump over any hurdle. They'll write 50-page term papers in the eighth grade for a pat on the back, and then they will break their necks performing. And some of you understand what I'm talking about. Some of you have been in that role, in whatever kind of job you have. So we're not talking about affirmation that's always correlated with performance. And the nicest illustration I know comes from a wealthy New York Jew, a very wealthy New York Jew, who has enormous self-esteem. And I asked him one day, I said, "Well, how did you develop this?" And he said, "You know, it was funny. For birthday, we do this and that. But you know, 4 or 5 times a year, every year, my dad would come home and he'd take me by the hand and we'd go down to the park and he'd give me a little present. And I'd say, 'Dad, what's this for?' And he'd say, 'You know, we can give you this and this and this and this because of what we have and because of birthdays or Christmas, or new Christmas, birthdays or holidays.' And he'd say, 'But this is for who you are.' And it wasn't the transaction of consumerism or a gift. It was a gift of love, not correlated with anything except a person's person. Well, you know, you need to do that for yourself too. You need to give yourself gifts of affirmation, not correlated just with times of success or performance." Okay, a comment or a question or two before we end today.
It's interesting that you brought this up with the Jewish father there. And that's been my observation with many Jewish families, a very strong ability to affirm their children. My son's the best, the best does stuff. And then we get resentful of these people who become the class presidents and this sort of thing, because they do have a healthy self-esteem. And in my background anyway, it was keep you humble, don't tell you how good you are because you're conceited and this sort of thing, which was exactly ask backwards.
He tells 3 stories that typify his development of self-esteem living in utter affluence. That's one. The other one is being taught at 16 that graciousness is champagne with a strawberry in it. What he means by that is that it's not about having, it's about savoring. And savoring who we are and savoring the moment. And the other one is that his mother would get up and clap her hands and say, "Let's have fun today." So those are the 3 foundational experiences for his sense of self. And you see, they're all affirmations, not correlated with performance. Well, use this for yourselves, your kids, anybody else. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.